Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Hey everyone, before we get started, I want to tell you about Blue Wire Hustle, a brand new program where you can host your very own podcast here at Blue Wire. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take your podcast to the next level. Or if you want to host a podcast and just don't know where to start, Hustle is the perfect place for you. As part of the program, you'll receive personal cover art, Q&As with Blue Wire's top podcasters, access to our community Discord, and an e-learning course full of tips and tricks. And on top of that, we'll help you get your show pushed out to Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and all other listening platforms. And the best part is, you can get all of this for only $15 a month, the same rate as any other hosting site would charge you just for the initial setup. So whether you're starting from scratch or have an existing show that you want to grow, Hustle is an open door to leveling up your sports podcasting experience. Acceptance into the program is limited, so get your application in today. To apply, go to bwhustle.com/join. Again, that is bwhustle.com/join. Check out the description box for this episode to find more, but that is bwhustle.com/join.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to a Monday afternoon edition of the Chase Thomas podcast presented by Blue Wire. I am joined by old friend Neil Payne. Neil, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you, Chase?
I am good. How goes the NBA watching? Who have you been watching a lot lately?
Well, I wrote about the Utah Jazz last week. Just I think everyone has. Yep. So they've definitely been a team that I've been looking at pretty closely. And, you know, we're just coming off a Bucks Clippers game. You know, there's all kinds of mid-season intrigue, I feel like, as we head into the All-Star break. And then it'll all just stop and reset, and then we'll kind of look forward to the second half.
Yeah, I'm excited. The Jazz we'll get to, because you've written about the Jazz. Friend of the pod, Jonathan Charks, has written about the Jazz. Everyone's talking about the Jazz in the podcast. The basketball discourse has gone off the deep end in some ways, where people really lost their minds. Were you watching that live when Michael Porter Jr. sprinted to the corner rather than going straight to the hoop in that game? I don't even remember who they were playing now, because that was several days ago, but Jamal Murray ended up doing a loop pass to, I don't even know, who did he even end up finding? I don't even remember off the top of my
head. This was the fast break that turned into a three-pointer?
Yes.
Yeah. I was not watching it live. I saw a lot of people reacting to it online, though.
Well, it's just, I saw there was, not to start any wars here, Neil, but there was a video that came out like the day after this all happened, and about like nerds are ruining sports because of this. Like, this was like something that spawned all of this, where it's like, well, no, that's not what analytics says. And there's a really good baseball podcast that talked about this. I think it's Baseball and Breakdowns on MLB.com by Mike Petriello, who talked about this, where he was saying, like, we just use this word analytics, and now no one even knows what that word means, and no one even understands, like, what that actually means, what it actually entails, how to use it. And I don't know, I got very frustrated listening to that video, and frustrated listening to the discourse and seeing the comments where it's like, yeah, basketball, like, this wouldn't happen 20 years ago. These players are getting brainwashed, and they're running to the corner when they're supposed to run to the rim. And it's like, well, no, that's the rim's the best shot. Like, that's what we all want. This was just like a collective brain fart, right?
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of something that I saw in football a lot also, especially this season during the playoffs, of this equating like something that I think analysts and numbers guys had sort of pushed for, which is being aggressive, maybe going for two or going for it on fourth down. I forget exactly what play led to this. And I think people like heard that enough. And in basketball, obviously, the version of that is shoot threes, that you kind of hear that enough and you think, OK, well, the analytics always say to go for it on fourth down. The analytics always say to shoot a three. And it's sort of like, that's not true. I mean, it may be true in a lot of cases, but there's still, you know, you have to either do the mental math or kind of intuit it as you're playing the game as to whether it makes sense to do something. So I think a lot of people have sort of heard these analytics, like, do this more type of, you know, guidelines that when people weren't doing those things almost at all or not nearly enough, maybe that was true, that just sort of drill it into your head to do this particular action a lot more and you'll win more. But I think that can be conflated with always do it, no matter the context. And I think nobody who is an analytics person would say there are any hard and fast rules as to, like, always do X, Y, Z. It's you know, to put yourself in the best position to win, consider doing this more, but don't overdo it if the situation demands, you know, something that's common sense. And I think on that particular play, I'm not sure what happened. I didn't necessarily hear what any of the players involved said, you know, their rationale was. But I think saying that it's, oh, well, the analytics told you to do that, is just kind of not true, even if you do a little back of the envelope math about, like, the odds of making even a wide open three versus the odds of converting on that fast break. And then, you know, even if you assume overtime, which you would force, would be a coin flip, it made sense to go to the rim and convert that and play for the tie. So I think that that's a case where it's sort of people are saying that analytics has advised a certain thing. But if you do even just rudimentary math, it's pretty clear that they would not advise that under that circumstance.
No, and I threw this at you, Neil, because I assume, I mean, I love 538, and you're not going to believe this, Neil, but sports can be complicated, and it's okay to enjoy both things, and it's okay to try and broaden your understanding by reading data and watching the games and using both. It's amazing that you could do both. But I imagine just like you put up with that a lot over the years of just like what kind of articles that you write and what people want. Is that still a thing, or is it this point that most basketball fans and most basketball readers at 538 are, they know what they're getting into and they know and they like it and they enjoy it?
Yeah, I think that's true, not just at our site, but across a lot of the places that write about basketball or break things down, is just that I think the audience is so sophisticated now and their expectations are just a lot more savvy about statistics and data that you don't have those people as much. I mean, it's still, you get the odd email, you get the odd tweet about, you know, watch the games aren't played in a spreadsheet or whatever, those old comments. But it really is kind of remarkable how in the last, 6-7 years, we've seen that go down so much. And now it really is almost the people are so savvy that they'll complain that you didn't necessarily, break down things in as much detail, or that you like forgot a certain aspect that might slightly tip the scales in a certain direction. So I think that's a good thing. I mean, it, I think, has elevated the level of discourse. You talked about the basketball discourse, capital B, capital mm-hmm. B. That the level of that is way, way, way higher than it was a decade ago. And I think it's not because of, any one particular outlet or anything like that. But I just think it's the way that fans want to consume the game now. They do want to watch, obviously, and people are, watching it constantly and tweeting about it and everything. But they also, like you said, they want that other avenue of enjoying it, which is, enjoying the numbers, diving into those and mixing those two together. So it's actually been great to see. I think it's very validating for somebody who was around at the very beginning of the analytics movement in basketball to see how much that has made its way into the way teams make decisions mm-hmm. and the way fans enjoy the game. It's really been kind of incredible that it has gotten so much traction. And if you compare that to something like baseball, which now is at the same level, people, the discourse is still is as analytical as it is in basketball. But it took a lot longer, and there was a lot of time since people like Bill James and folks like that started first breaking down baseball in that way. It took a lot longer for it to get to this point, whereas in basketball, it's been a lot in a comparatively much shorter period of time to get to this level of discourse.
I will say, writing about baseball is significantly more nerve-wracking for me than basketball writing. And it's because it's just, I read so many smart baseball people, and like, when you feel kind of like, I can't match what Jay Jaffe or Keith Law are bringing to the table. I can't bring, like, what am I doing? Like, you read the Baseball Prospectus writers and the Fangraphs writers and the Beyond the Box Score writers, and it's just, you just feel inept. I'm like, I majored in journalism. I'm in grad school for communications. I'm not well-versed enough. I don't feel confident enough in what I'm doing. Like, I understand Weighted Runs Created Plus, but like, there's still something about it where like, it's nerve-wracking to write about baseball, I think, nowadays. But I just wanted to throw that at you because that was something that I thought about. It was not even on a run, but I was just thinking about that, Neil. Who have you been watching this week, though, a lot of? What basketball team have you noticed that you've been drawn to more on League Pass or anywhere else?
Well, the Heat, I think we're going to talk about them later also, but I've noticed, I have this output of teams that are sort of hot or cold over the past week, over the past 2 weeks, and the Heat have been the hottest team over the past 2 weeks. They've edged out Phoenix, they've edged out Washington, has kind of put on a little bit of a run, and then Memphis is a team that's been the hottest over the past week. They've won 2 out of 3, really put a hurting on Houston, which, is, depending on the night, either that is raises an eyebrow or doesn't, depending on what's going on with them at a given time. But yeah, I think a lot of people, the Jazz have been sucking up so much of the oxygen in the room because they've been on this incredible hot streak that I think maybe people start turning their attention toward second half storylines storylines that include them, but also like the teams that seem to be maybe figuring out, maybe turning things around, and just what the second half has in store, because the we didn't even know the schedule. I mean, we had a rough idea of it, but we didn't know for sure what that would look like until last week. So I think that that's kind of where I'm at, and sort of thinking about, yes, the All-Star break and all of that, but also thinking about teams that maybe didn't have the best first half or maybe underperformed, but are they going to be able to turn things around? Because it was such a strange, compressed offseason. You know, there was a lot of player movement in like the weeks leading up to opening day. And so I think it's fair to give some of the teams in the first half maybe a little bit of a pass compared to what you usually would, because there just wasn't enough time to develop a rhythm around, you know, the new faces and the new lineups that teams are trying to go with.
Yeah, and we'll get to my favorites in the Jazz and the Heat as of right now, because they're both different. They're interesting for very different reasons, I think. A team that I have watched a lot of this year, I don't know how much you've watched of them, but the Patrick Williams pick, I think, surprised a lot of people when that happened. There's still a lot of people that are in on Wendell Carter. Lauri Markkanen, I'm less in on. But Zach LaVine playing really good basketball for them this year. Kobe White now turning into maybe the question mark, where it's like, okay, like I penciled him, this is DJ Augustine. And now it's like, okay, maybe he could be a starting point guard in this league. And then you go back and forth, and there's some games that he shows it, and there are others that you're not. And you're like, well, I mean, it's not going to be on this team because you can't have a backcourt of Zach LaVine and Kobe White in today's NBA. It's just too small. They're just going to get shredded all the time. But then you watch them play, and Thad Young is just a gobbling machine on the boards, and it makes sense. Like, you look at their guys who play, and outside of Denzel Valentine, who results in plays where he'll take some crazy one-footer, and Zach LaVine will just put his hands up like, what are you doing? The Bulls are really, really fascinating to me. They're in the mix of the playoffs. They're a 500 team. Billy Donovan's really coaching them up well. But what's interesting, maybe more so than anything, a Zach LaVine offense with this group is extremely efficient. How the Bulls become such an efficient team this season offensively?
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Yeah, there are, you know, I was talking about the looking at teams that had been really coming on over the past few weeks. They're right there in that conversation. You know, maybe not quite as strong as a team like Miami, but they're sort of gaining steam. And yeah, it does seem to have a lot to do with their offense. I mean, they're 15th in offensive rating. So it's sort of like it's an improvement on what they were last year. I believe they were 27th and just seemed totally out of sorts. But, you know, they're starting to kind of figure things out. And you're right that this is a team that has some different pieces from last year. You know, no more Chris Dunn. You've got Patrick Williams in that mix. You know, Garrett Temple, some of these guys that they're kind of figuring things out. I think that that's an example of what we were just talking about. And yeah, Zach LaVine has been one of the most improved offensive players, at least in the league, I think. And you could say, you could just look at Thaddeus Young. I think I'm glad you mentioned him, because he is kind of a bellwether for them as a guy that really was frankly not all that great last year and didn't really seem to have like the right role for him. And I'm a huge Thaddeus Young fan, you know, going back to Georgia Tech.
I knew this was coming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really one of my favorite all-time players, because I feel like he's been one of the most underrated players in the league for a long time. Like, when we look back on his career, I don't think he's going to be a Hall of Famer. Yeah, I don't think he's going to be a Hall of Famer, but at the same time, he'll probably in that like Hall of very good kind of category where people didn't necessarily appreciate him in his time, and then they look back when he's finally retired. And I should say, he's still only 32. You know, he's got a lot left in his tank, even though he feels like he's been around forever at this point.
Yeah.
But he's a guy that just does like a lot of different stuff well. And maybe that was why last year, you know, seeing him not really be able to carve out like the right offensive role was a little jarring. Well, this year, you know, they're having him do more distributing. His assist rate is up, I believe, 15 percentage points this year compared with last year. He's playing way more efficiently and scoring really well. And it's kind of interesting because this is another thing that goes maybe against the analytics, is you would think a guy taking fewer threes would become less efficient, but Thaddeus Young has taken way fewer threes and he's become a lot more efficient this year. But I think it's about the role that he's playing in that offense. And the fact that he's not a guy that they need to play that role, because they have other guys that can kind of slot in and do that job. And having him play as more of kind of a passer, I think, and an inside scorer, has contributed to their improvement on offense as much as anything. So it's great to see him be kind of the focal point. And I don't know what the potential of this team is. You know, I think that they still have a ways to go to really be much more than a team that, you know, like in the East, obviously, a lot of different teams of perhaps mediocre quality are going to make the playoffs. But I don't know that the Bulls can make noise, but I think it's encouraging to see them try to kind of figure out the mix of talent that they have. And I would think that they would be a better team in the second half than they have been for most of the first half.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see how they look at the deadline, because this is a new front office. It's not just a new coaching staff, it's a new front office. They are not attached to any of these pieces. Like, some of these are very recent lottery picks, but they're not attached to any of them. So it depends on, what does Jerry Reinsdorf want to get in the playoffs this year? Does he want some playoff revenue? Because there will be at least some fans for these games. So does he, just looking at this season, like, yeah, we're not moving LaVine or Young or any of these guys? No, let's just do this, make the playoffs, get a little bit of extra revenue, and see what happens next year. But I mean, it's
and I like that. Yeah. You know, I think that maybe now we're in a point, I know, having gone through the process and the influx of tanking across the league, I do hope that teams like the Bulls are kind of indicative of maybe a new dawn, in which it's okay to aim for like a pretty good team, a decent team, you know, and roll the dice and see what happens. Especially, like I said, in the East, you know, there aren't that many teams that are that are better than 500. I'll say, I think there's only four teams that are better than 500 in the East. So this is a situation where you could just a little bit of effort and a little bit of, like, you know, going out and getting like one small minor role player type of piece could vault you into like a home advantage in a first round playoff series or something like that, as crazy as that is to say. So I do think there's an extra advantage to that by being in that in the East compared with the West, where you're going to have a 500 team maybe miss the playoffs, or above 500 team if they're unlucky and right around the fringe.
Absolutely. Are you out on Lauri Markkanen?
I don't know. I mean, you know, he's still 23. I don't think that he's shown the improvement that you would like to see, but he's still playing a little bit better than last year. I think his offensive efficiency gives you hope that he could potentially be, you know, a pretty good role player, you know, on a decent team. I think that that's kind of, maybe that's not what people were expecting for him when he came into the league. But at the same time, you know, I'm not like giving up on a 23-year-old that has a 116 offensive rating.
Fair. Jalen Brunson. A lot of people, if you don't watch a lot of Mavs games this year, you might not know that he's closing for the Mavs, and that he is an important guy next to Luka Doncic, and he takes a lot of stuff off Luka's plate when he needs to. Josh Richardson has not been good for Dallas this year. He's getting a little bit better as of late, but Jalen Brunson has been kind of the key cog in that backcourt to keep everything going. Losing Seth Curry really hurt them, and that trade does not look all that great for Dallas this early on. But How important in your estimation is Jalen Brunson for Dallas to get back to 500 right now?
Yeah, I think he is important for that reason that you talk about, having someone who's like a supporting creator and ball handler other than Luka. And maybe the Mavs showed, you know, last year they were hyper efficient offensively and they did it with Luka just taking on basically all of the weight and all of the workload. Like I think they're, you know, DeLon Wright was their second highest assist rate guy during the regular season. Now, you know, he's not there. And so I think it's almost like when people talk about this word heliocentrism in basketball and kind of putting everything on your star and having them make all the decisions and every play filtered through them. You know, we've seen that work to certain degrees or another. You know, James Harden is kind of the ultimate heliocentric player, and maybe in NBA history. You know, maybe Wilt Chamberlain is the one exception to that. But I do think that maybe, you know, the Mavs saw a little bit of the limits of that approach last year when you have Luka just basically doing all the facilitating and everyone else on the team is, you know, working around him on that. And so it's been encouraging to see Jalen Brunson slot in there. Obviously, Luka's having a great season as well. But just to be that secondary creator, that secondary facilitator that I do think teams need, you know, as much as we love the heliocentric approach and having your star be involved in everything, there are, I think, are limits to that. And it makes you easier to defend in a lot of ways, even if you have somebody like Luka who is so transcendent. So just having someone else out there that can also be a threat to create, not just for themselves, but for other players and kind of work around your star, I think that's important to have.
Absolutely. I love thinking about all the different young players. I love thinking about what this point in time when it's all critical to see where they're going to be and what kind of players. Are they going to be role players? Are they gonna, like, when, like, what age do they get to where it's like, okay, we're not, this is it. This is who they are. And Sam Vecenie does a really good job of this at The Athletic. And I wanted to pick your brain on this because the 31 through 50 number, those guys are more interesting to me. Like, they're the ones that are, like, definite that we know. We know who these people are going to be. They're going to be the stars. Like, those are the easy identifiers. That's not really interesting to me. The ones that's interesting, it's like, PJ Washington, who went for 42 last night. And you're like, well, if PJ Washington is a difference maker, because they already hit on LaMelo. We know they hit on LaMelo. We know what Terry Rozier is off ball for the Hornets. We know what a lot of these guys are. And it's like, oh, suddenly they have more intrigue, because for every Malik Monk you miss on, you need to have some PJ Washingtons that you hit on. And the draft is an inexact science and it's difficult. That all being said, from this group, Who do you believe in the most to this point? Who fascinates you, maybe, is the better way of framing this, the most?
Well, I mean, some of the names on there are interesting. They've been playing well, but, you know, somebody like Derek White, he's already 26. I kind of see that as being like, maybe he's a guy who's peaking and playing really well. But, you know, some of a younger player has more room to grow. So I've got my eye on some of the younger names on the list. Like, I think Jared Allen is really interesting. You know, he's a guy that rates really well in our metric called Raptor, which measures a player's contribution. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Don't ask me to remember what the acronym stands for. But it measures your impact on the court, essentially, per 100 possessions, and it accounts for all these different factors, not only just box score stats, but also your on-court versus off-court impact, your player tracking stats, and all these things, and tries to kind of figure out, you know, who has been adding value while they're on the court. And Jared Allen is a guy the past couple seasons that has been one of the better big men in that metric. He's a plus 3.9 per 100 possessions guy this year. And he's only 22. So I think that makes him really interesting. I also like Dante DiVincenzo. You know, he's a guy that I think has gotten a little more attention in recent years, or just this past year. And obviously people watching the Bucks know that he's a valuable player. But maybe they don't necessarily know how valuable he is, because according to our metric, he's been 3.3 points per 100 better than an average player, which would make you very valuable to have as sort of a supporting player around somebody like Giannis. So I got my eye on those two guys. And like I said, Derek White is probably the highest rated player on that list. But at age 26, I mean, he's a big reason why San Antonio has been exceeding expectations for sure. But if we're talking about future potential versus, you know, current potential at age 26, we might be just seeing a guy who's really underrated and really good, just in having one of his peak seasons, I guess, which is not a bad thing, obviously. Another note on all these guys, you know, I liked that you zeroed in on numbers 31 through 50 because it does give you, you know, gives you a mix of names like Lonzo Ball.
Yeah.
That's an interesting name to be on that list and sort of trying to figure out, you know, he's only 23. And he's been playing better this season than last season. Mm-hmm. So he might have more growth potential. But I think so much for so many of these guys centers around the situation that they're in. Mm-hmm. And I think the majority of NBA players, like we like to think about the stars and we like to think about the players that can be successful in any context, in any situation. But the vast majority of players, even players who are really interesting and really talented and have a lot of really intriguing upside potential, they are often a product of the situation and the fit and the role that they're being asked to play. So I think that this 31 through 50 tier, if we're ranking, you know, young players or players that could be potential prospects, you know, to improve over the next year or two, the situation and the fit is so important for them. And I think all of these guys in the right situation could be really valuable players. And it's going to be interesting to see, like, you know, what, how many of them find their way into those roles, find their way into those situations, and you know, the ones that don't, can they be reclamation projects elsewhere?
Absolutely. The Jazz. We got to get to the Jazz and the Heat. The two main events of this podcast, Neil. The Jazz. In your estimation, based on what you found in your piece and what you've been seeing from the Jazz this season, are they just a regular season machine, a souped up version of the Hawks from years ago, or are they realistic title contenders that can get through a situation where they beat the Clippers and or Lakers in the Western Conference Finals and then the Brooklyn Nets in the NBA Finals? Are they well enough equipped to do that?
Well, I want to preface this by saying that this season seems a little bit less predictable than a normal NBA season. And I think that's important to remember. And that works in the favor of a team like the Jazz, I think, in the sense that, you know, normally we have this like hard and fast rule of, you know, you have to have X number of superstars or you have to, you know, have one of this like predetermined list of players that we all kind of know from before the season in order to realistically contend. And I don't think any of the players on the Jazz, even, you know, your Rudy Gobert's, your Donovan Mitchell's, your Mike Conley's, I don't think anybody really had those guys as on their list of, okay, these are title contending leading type players. But I think in a season like this, where there just is so much uncertainty around, you know, coming back from the bubble, coming back from the virus season, you know, still having the virus play a big role, at least, you know, to this point in the season, that I think maybe we can ease off on those hard and fast rules, maybe a little bit compared with history. And I also think that the perception of the Jazz as not being as superstar laden of a team or not being one of those teams at all is maybe a little misguided. I do think you could make a case for somebody like Rudy Gobert to, while not being like, obviously not a LeBron level impact player, not a Kawhi level impact player, but being, you know, at the edge of that conversation. And I think the way Mike Conley has played this season, you could make a case for him too. He's been one of the most improved players probably ever between seasons, if you look at him coming back from injury last year and telegraphing a little bit of that improvement in the playoffs last year, and then, you know, just having this incredible season. Donovan Mitchell is another guy that, you know, has parlayed playing really well in the playoffs last year to, you know, playing really well this season. So I think it's a little bit of, you know, the rules around superstars might not apply as much this season, and then a little bit of maybe the Jazz have more superstar talent on hand than we tend to give them credit for, because we've kind of made up our minds usually most seasons about who are the stars that can lead superstar team, you know, championship caliber teams. And maybe we have left somebody like Gobert out of that conversation unjustly.
I think part of it too is that, like, I think two things can be true. One, we can stick to that rule that has not plagued us, the superstar rule. We can just stand by it for a little bit, and also just be like, this is an opportunity for them to prove us wrong. Like, it's okay to just be like, hey, like, the Jazz, it's a possibility. Like, you shouldn't just write them off. It's okay to challenge preconceived notions about how we view sports and who can really contend and who doesn't. Let's just see. Like, that's why we play these games, is to actually see what happens. Can the Jazz impose their will, and just how well they've mastered pick and roll offense and pick and roll defense with their players? And, you know, if all of them are hot, if Royce O'Neal is hot, Bogdanovich is hot, and Joe Ingles does enough on the wing in defensive moments, and it's like, and Conley keeps this going for a full season, then you never know. Maybe if they play this season back 100 times, the Jazz win the title 25 times. Like, and one of those 25 times is what actually happens. I think it's a possibility, right?
Yeah, and I think also, like, the flip side of it is, think about a team like the Celtics. You know, mm-hmm. that would be a team that maybe we would have considered Jaylen Brown or some combination of, like, Brown plus Tatum or Walker or Smart or whomever as having the potential to be a championship team. And I'm not, like, writing them off, but based on the way that they've played versus a team like the Jazz, I do think that that kind of upends our expectations about, like, this exercise of trying to decide who can lead a team to a championship, you know, on paper, based on the tiers in which they're in. Because by all rights, the Celtics should be that team that's in that conversation, not the Jazz, on paper. And yet I think that the way that the two teams have trended kind of flips it around on its head.
Well, I think it's also just, like, how quickly things can shift in a year. And I think the Celtics and the Jazz are interesting parallels here, where, like, the Jazz play a style that seemingly is more conducive to the regular season. The Celtics play a style that is more conducive to the playoffs. But also, they both have a very, very expensive point guard around a very just enticing young wing, guard, whichever wing, combo player, whatever you want to call them. And that creates a problem, because Mike Conley was not good last year. That really hurt the Jazz. That trade did not really look good last year. And we come into this year with lowered expectations for Conley, where it's like, oh man, maybe this is it. And he's never going to get back to an all-star capable level. The flip side is Kemba is nowhere near what he was last year. So the Celtics trajectory just looks different, because they're not getting the Conley type production from him. So the Celtics stuff, they're going to be faced with a very difficult decision. And if you look at the history of Danny Ainge, he doesn't make big midseason moves. That's just not what the Celtics do. So when people throw around, what are the Celtics going to do to get out of the 500? I'm like, probably nothing. Like, they're probably just not going to do anything. Because that's never what they do. And they just hope that Kemba gets healthy. Like, that's what they're going to probably bet on, is Kemba figures it out. And they paid Kemba a lot of money to figure it out. So you bet on the guy you paid a lot of money to. But also, you let Gordon Hayward go for nothing except for a trade exception. And that really hurts, because Gordon's been really good for Boston. But I think the most difficult situation that Boston will find themselves in the next 6 months is Marcus Smart is our best distributor. And that's a problem. And if you want to have more conducive regular season success, where you still have Jaylen and Tatum when you need it come playoff time, but you need something to make the regular season easier for those two guys, well, then you have to move Marcus Smart for another guy who can move the ball in the Gordon Hayward type role, because it's just, the offense is going to be stagnant. Like, they don't get any hockey assists. They don't do any of the easy stuff that you use to grind out regular season wins. And I just don't see an avenue of them fixing that midseason.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it talks a lot about Kemba's, you know, health, I think, and whether he's at full strength. And if you want a comparison point on that, again, Mike Conley might be an interesting comparison point, because he wasn't right for, you know, the majority of the regular season, especially early on last year. Mm-hmm. He kind of battled on through, like, hamstring problems and just wasn't the same player. And when, you know, the long layoff happened, they come back in the bubble, he's a lot better, you know. And I don't know if it's rest, I don't know if it's just, you know, getting right physically. It's probably a combination of all those things, and I don't know how replicable that will be this year for somebody like Kemba. But it's an example of, you know, who a team is now is not necessarily the finished product, and so mm-hmm. much of it has to do with guys being banged up and fighting their way through. And Conley now obviously seems very right, and he seems very very healthy and kind of playing his best basketball maybe of his whole career, which is saying something.
Absolutely. On the flip side, the Miami Heat, they're getting healthy outside of Jimmy, who's still missing some time here and there. Kendrick Nunn back to his normal role, and that's paid dividends for them. The Heat winning six straight. They have the longest win streak in basketball. They beat the Hawks last night because the Hawks do not know how to close a basketball game. That is some breaking news that I would like to break on this very podcast. Neil, what has changed for the Heat, and are you now just like, okay, yeah, they'll be fine?
Yeah, well, I was kind of waiting for this from them anyway, just because I knew that they wouldn't keep playing at the level, the kind of listless early season level that they had been doing forever. And so some of this is probably just regression back to a better mean, the type of which that we saw from them when things were going right last season. Like, you know, they're shooting 37% from three over this winning streak. That's better than they had been doing by a little bit going in. And they're playing better defense, I think, also, you know, so it's kind of a combination of a lot of different things coming together. And I hesitate to think about them. You know, I mentioned teams that made a lot of changes and turned things over gelling, because this is pretty much the same team from last year, you know, give or take a little bit. It has not changed roster wise all that much from last year, give or take maybe just Butler, whether he's in the lineup versus out. And they were one of the teams that changed the least about their roster between, you know, last season and this season. But I think the most of it can be explained by just them. You know, they were always going to find some kind of hot streak and play better than they had been to start the season, just because, like, this is not a sub-500 team on paper. You know, I think I had a little bit of a doubt about whether they could truly run it back and go to the finals again, for instance. I think that was a little bit much to expect from them, just because everything kind of fell into place for them during the playoffs last year. But at the same time, you know, they're too talented to be where they were a couple weeks ago or a month ago.
They're a team, unlike the Celtics, that would actually do something. And I am curious to see what the Miami Heat eventually do, because they have Bam, they're nursing Jimmy, and Jimmy's waiting for the postseason, but they still got to get there. And I don't know. I think bringing Goran Dragic back was a good thing, and just the chemistry. And you look at their young guys, they're developing well, but like the Tyler Hero question still looms large over that organization and what they really actually believe he can be. And Pat Riley, we know, is he'll go the all chips in if he feels like he needs to. And we haven't really seen a team respond to Giannis signing the Supermax in Milwaukee yet, right? Like, that is still looming. Is the teams that were preparing to make a real run at Giannis Antetokounmpo have not been like, okay, he's out, so what do we do next? That next move has not happened for any of these teams around the league that were like the Dallases, the Miamis, who, and even the Torontos, who were really poised to make a real run at Giannis, and now suddenly that's off the table. So who are you going to make a run at instead? And we haven't seen what they're going to do yet. It might be Bradley Beal, it might not. I don't know. I'm very curious to see what these teams end up doing. What do you think Victor Oladipo is actually worth right now, Neil? Do you think he'll come to regret not just taking the two-year extension in Houston and just revitalizing his career on a bad team and putting up some crazy numbers? Because when I saw that, I'm like, what does Victor Oladipo think his value is right now? And where does he think he's going to get? Does he still think, because he works out in Miami, that he's going to get the Miami money? I don't know.
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty fair offer.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I mean, it's probably just comes down to, you know, he's a guy that he's a confident guy. He wants to bet on himself. And, you know, he has played a lot better than he did, you know, coming off of that injury. At least in our metric, he had been a little bit down. And this is a guy that was kind of an MVP candidate before he got hurt, but was clearly not fully right. So I think he seems in a lot better of a place this season than he was even, you know, last season, or much less a couple years ago. So I don't know. He's betting on himself. He's 28. So he's kind of in his prime. I think that teams are sort of hesitant to put down a lot of years, especially now in the climate of, you know, reduced revenue from not having fans in the stands, that, you know, they're probably going to be a little hesitant to put big offers for long periods of time in front of guys that are in that, like, next tier of, you know, they're not necessarily franchise players. And I think probably Victor Oladipo thinks of himself as a franchise player, and he was that in Indiana. And I don't know. I think maybe there's a disconnect there between how Houston sees him, because I thought that I liked that move where they picked him up in that flurry of moves around the Harden trade.
It also looked good when they were healthy. Like, did. Wall, Oladipo, Wood, it looked good.
Yeah, and I thought that particular combination was an opportunity when you have Christian Wood, you know, making this huge breakthrough, and John Wall looking more like the John Wall that we're used to, that would signal, you know, this is the core that we can kind of reload around for a team that never really, in the past, at least traditionally, and some of that is just they had Harden, but they're not a team known for having, you know, long periods of rebuilding and starting from scratch. They're a team that basically continuously, if you think back for a long period of time, they were able to kind of go from almost going back to like the Hakeem Olajuwon era. They never really had much longer than, you know, a year or two of kind of reloading. And then they would get Tracy McGrady or Yao. And then they would load from that and they would get Harden, you know. And so it's been a pretty continuous period of being competitive, or at least, you know, good in Houston. So, yeah, I'm kind of interested in, if Oladipo's not part of their future, like, what was the upside of that move? And also, where do you go from here? And what does the future for that team look like? Because Christian Wood looks like a really, really great building block to kind of build the next competitive Rockets team around. Yeah. And you would think somebody like Oladipo would also be part of that.
He just seems like a really hard one to gauge, like, what he really wants. And I don't think he knows what he wants. I don't think he knows where he wants to be. The injury stuff really hurt him. And just, I'm sure it weighed on him a lot, like the off the court drama with Miles Turner and everything. He's just had a really, really rough year. So I don't know. I think he probably just wants stability and wants to get a 4-year deal from someone, and just someone to be like, hey, we see you as our franchise guy. Not like the 2-year deal signals, we see you as a transitional guy. Right. And not someone we see as a cornerstone that we want to put billboards up for. And I guess he still sees himself as like the lead guy somewhere. And he wants someone to invest in him, which I understand.
And I was going to say, I don't think that is necessarily wrong. I mean, maybe some of it is also proving that he has the durability to be that guy. Because I think that might be where the bigger element of the disconnect is, not like his performance when he's on the court. It's just his ability to stay on the court. You know, I don't necessarily know that you would give a longer term deal to a guy if you knew that he was going to be, you know, in and out of the lineup so much.
Absolutely. You know, where he actually makes a lot of sense this offseason, and who should really actually throw him a lot of money, is Orlando, the original team that drafted him. Different group, but they are weak in the guard department, and who knows when Fultz will get back. That's just such a sad story that feels like forever ago now. Last thing, we'll wrap up here, Neil. The Pacers. I've always been very high on them. I'm very high on teams that literally play zero bad players in the rotation. I think that is an underrated part, and the Indiana Pacers have been a machine when it comes to, we're only going to play competent, average, or above average players at all times. Like, every player on the court at all times will have some sort of role, some sort of upside that, like, okay, these five all are quality NBA players. And I think that's always going to keep them in the top four. So when I saw, like, preseason stuff, like, they're out of the playoffs, I'm like, there's no way. They're too old. Who's the young guy? Like, who's the young guy who's upending this rotation where they're all 26 years old and know what to do on a basketball court? I didn't ever saw it. But then they trade Victor Oladipo, and they have the Caris LeVert thing that may or may not have saved his life, which is amazing. And he's away, and he's coming back this month, because it's somehow already March now. Brogdon's awesome. Like, he's one of my favorite players to watch in the NBA just because of how different of a guard he is. When you watch everybody else, just he plays differently. Doug McDermott is just a slashing machine. Sabonis, an all-star. Turner and him still work for whatever reason, but they're still struggling. They're in that hodgepodge now, without the guard play they need, the scoring they need. And I'm not sure, without TJ Warren, who, another, speaking of the bubble, just the bubble Michael Jordan, TJ Warren, not having him around and not having Caris LeVert because they moved on from Oladipo in that trade. Like, they need something there, and they'll get LeVert back, hopefully at full strength, middle of March. But do you think they can survive and still be a playoff team with the group they have right now and relying so much on Sabonis and Malcolm Brogdon?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we're not used to seeing the Pacers be, you know, tied for the 9 seed or whatever they are in the East right now, especially given just the other teams that are in the mix. Are you joking that, you know, they're behind the Knicks? They're behind, you know, some of these other teams in this conversation. I always thought that the Pacers would, you know, just make the playoffs as a competent, if not, you know, championship quality team, you know, every year for eternity. I thought that that was how things worked there. But yeah, I think Sabonis has, you know, been hurt by not having more offensive firepower around him. I think that's kind of one of the storylines of them. And you're totally right that, you know, they have not had that replacement ever since they traded Oladipo. And LeVert was supposed to be that. I'm hopeful that when he does come back, first of all, that it will be, you know, sooner rather than later. I think it's supposed to be in March. So that could be, you know, right after the All-Star break, or it could be, you know, deeper into the month. And that might actually make a big difference for them, because that's the ingredient they've been missing, as well as TJ Warren played, you know, when he was healthy. But just having a player in that role to replace Oladipo, I think is big for them. And, you know, Sabonis, I know he's an all-star type player, but, you know, if you look at the metrics defensively, he's not the best. If you look at his impact at that end. So you really need him to make a huge impact offensively. And this year, our system doesn't have him as being a particularly great offensive player. He's kind of average. And if your best offensive player, if your go-to guy on offense is going to be, you know, an average player. And I guess Brogdon has been better than that. And you could say that he's been the, you know, a go-to guy for them. But that's not necessarily a recipe for being much better than, you know, a mediocre 500-ish team. And that's kind of been where they are, hovering around the edge of the playoff picture, which is just weird to see them fall to that level, because they had been so great last year. Yep. And I think people were struggling for an explanation for why they were so great. And I think you hit on something really interesting, the idea that they just had an accumulation of pretty good players. You know, there's something to be said for just gathering a bunch of guys who play really good. Maybe they're not amazing, and maybe none of them are superstars. But at the same time, if you just fill your minutes with guys that are competent, you can make the playoffs and be a pretty good seed, I think. And so that's been the difference this year. Is, you know, last year, just looking at the numbers of their top six players in minutes, five of them were pretty good, if not like really good. And this year, only two of their top five have been above average, and that's been Justin Holiday and Miles Turner. So, and Sabonis has had kind of a down year compared with last year. So I think that tells a lot of the story of that recipe of filling all of your minutes with guys that are pretty good, having pretty good seasons, just isn't quite the same this year.
Absolutely. Well, Neil, this has been great. I appreciate you making the time for me today. What can we check out from you across Hot Takedown, a very good sports podcast that you should listen to, or 538?
Yeah, well, at 538, I'm kind of always writing about something. We put out a project last week about, you know, after the news that MLB was officially recognizing the Negro League statistics as being, you know, official Major League statistics, which I think was announced in December. We did this big project last week where it was kind of a get to know the stars of the Negro Leagues better. You know, if you're a fan of a certain player, either a Hall of Fame or a current player, we have a tool that allows you to find, like, well, who was the Negro League's equivalent of that? So if you're a Mike Trout fan, well, Oscar Charleston is his doppelganger among these great players that are finally being recognized for their accomplishments. So I would encourage everybody to go and check that out at the site. It's interactive where you can kind of get lost in all the comparisons and spend a lot of time just scrolling through. We have these little, like, baseball cards that break down each player. What they were great at, and that drives the comparisons as well.
Absolutely. Well, go do that. Keep up the great work, Neil. Thank you so much for the time. I greatly appreciate it, and we will check back in again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Chase.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.